You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live today from the, a Hyatt, a Hilton, whatever it is, this hotel downtown here, where the Health Action 2013 conference is being put on by Families USA. And I'm here on the radio row, and Senator Tom Harkin is on the line with us, the Democrat from Iowa. In just a moment, he will be here with us. And hello? Okay, Senator Harkin.
Hello.
Hey, how are you today?
Is this Tom?
It is.
Hey, Tom, nice to be with you. Just fine.
Thank you
for having me on, and thanks for doing this great service that you guys are doing over there.
Oh, yeah, we're having a great time.
I'm sorry I couldn't come over there personally. I was going to, but, you know, we have a whole bunch of votes going on here right now.
I understand, and I'm sure you already have, but I'll pass that along to the folks here. So you're the chair of the Senate Health Committee. This is a pretty big deal. This is the Health Action Conference, and there's lots of speakers and things, but I understand that you're going to be introducing legislation to help Americans struggling with medical debt.
Yes. I'm sorry. Say that again, Tom.
I understand that there's some legislation being put forward to help Americans struggling with medical debt that goes beyond Obamacare, or is this part of Obamacare?
Well, it's kind of a part of Obamacare, but basically we want to make sure that the Affordable Care Act extends to everyone, and that makes sure that when people go on the exchange that they have the enough tax benefits and tax support, monetary support, so that they can afford the insurance on the exchange. Secondly, we want to make sure that all of those who fall below the poverty line, if states, you know, because of that Supreme Court decision, states don't have to expand Medicaid now. Well, if they don't expand Medicaid, mm-hmm. then we want to make sure that people who fall below that poverty line are able to somehow access that exchange so that they, too, will be covered. Mm-hmm. There's a gap there. Right now, states might insure it up to 100% of poverty. Under the Affordable Care Act, we said Medicaid should be extended from 133% to 400% of poverty. Mm-hmm. If states don't do that, there's going to be a gap of people in there that won't get Medicaid, and they won't be eligible for the exchange. So my legislation is going to make sure we fill in that gap.
To what extent does any of that have anything to do with or is affected by some of these wackadoodle, my word, not yours, Republican governors who are saying that they're not going to take Medicaid money from the federal government, even if it's 100% payment, because, you know, actually I haven't heard a coherent because government is bad or because it's taxpayer money that might have come from a billionaire or something. I don't know what the deal is, but you understand what I'm talking about.
I do, Tom, and quite frankly, I think a lot of these Republican governors are going to be hearing from their hospitals. They're going to be hearing from their doctors. They're going to be hearing from other health care providers in their states who are saying, wait a second. You know, we're caring for these people anyway. They come into the emergency room, and so we're paying for it, and that's not the best way to do it. It'd be easier if they were covered with insurance so that they could get health care coverage before they get too sick and come to the emergency room. So I think a lot of these governors, Republican governors who say they're not going to expand it, are certainly going to hear from their hospitals all over their states saying that what you're basically doing is saying to the hospitals, you eat all this, you absorb it all.
Yeah.
And it makes no sense for any Republican governor not to expand the Medicaid as we have in the Affordable Care Act.
On the other hand, this was something that Richard Nixon proposed in 72 or 73, as I recall.
Yeah, right.
And it was not embraced by the hard right on the at that time it was the John Birch Society, Fred Koch, Daddy Koch, and they didn't have the Tea Party, but they had their variation of it, and then, you know, it was embraced by the Heritage Foundation and by Mitt Romney and Romney Care in Massachusetts. And,
yeah,
it seems like this. I mean, people make jokes about Republicans don't live in a fact-based world, but this is people's lives.
Tom, you're right. It is. It's just these are people's lives. We know the facts, as you say. The facts are that this is a cheaper and better way of making sure we take care of people when they get sick or try to keep them healthy in the first place. This ideological thing about these governors, about not expanding Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, as you say, it's not fact-based. And the hospitals will tell the governors, look, we're spending this money anyway. Unless, Tom, that hard right wing, and there are some who probably believe that if you're poor and you don't have any money and you get sick, just go out and die, or go out in the street and just be sick and die.
Well, isn't that in a very real way, and you know your colleagues better than I, but kind of a variation on Calvinism? I mean, back to a couple hundred years ago when there was this general belief that, as Thomas Hobbes said, you know, without the iron fist of church or state, the natural state of man would be nasty, brutish, and short. I'm paraphrasing badly, but
right,
I'm sure you know
right.
what I'm talking about. And so the challenge became, how do we find those few good men who can run the church and the state? Now, the church figured out their own way to do that. But for the state, it was like, how do we find people who are genuinely good? And the Calvinistic notion was, well, look at who God has blessed. You know, the rich people, obviously, they must be the good ones, so they should be the ones in charge. And the extension of that is the poor ones are obviously the morally deficient ones. And so really we shouldn't worry about them. Let God take care of them in the afterlife, and it'll all sort itself out. I'm sure nobody's talking like that explicitly and out loud in the Senate, but when I debate these conservatives on this program, that sure bleeds through. Do you think that there's any sense of that, or is there some other rationale for this, for the whole let them die, as you just said, that I'm completely missing?
Well, no, Tom, I think you put your finger on it. I think it's just this attitude that I think a lot of my Republican colleagues have, that, well, if we don't do it, someone will pick it up. There will be some charity. There will be somebody out there who will make sure that they don't go into the street and die. And
but it hasn't worked out that way.
Pardon?
But it hasn't worked out that way.
No, it doesn't work out that way. And what happens? People just get sicker and sicker and sicker. They're a burden on their families. And I suppose, I mean, I just don't think we as a society are going to be that hard-hearted. We just aren't.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, if we're not going to have that kind of Calvinistic type of approach, then we have to say, what's the most rational, most cost-effective manner of making sure these people get health care
right.
coverage?
Right. And it seems like this is a good start.
This is a good start. What we're trying to do is a good start. And like I said, if these Republican governors have a better way of covering these people, but they have no other way of coming up with that.
Yeah. Well, I hope you're right that their constituents are hearing from them. Access to media is kind of limited in some of these states, and the stories that they get out are pretty odd. Anything new? We just have a half a minute here. Anything new on the Affordable Care Act front that we should know about, that our listeners and viewers should know about?
Well, not that I can tell you it's very new. It's just that, again, the Republicans, again, keep trying to take money out of the Prevention and Wellness Fund that I put in there. And, again, that flies in the face of facts. We know, as your mother said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
There you go. You're absolutely right. Senator Tom Harkin, thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for being such an advocate for all of us human beings here on planet Earth. Great to talk with you, sir.
Tom Hartman, thank you for all the good you do. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more from the Health Action 2013 Families USA Conference right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We are live and on the air from the Health Action 2013 Families USA Conference it's the Hyatt, isn't it?
At the Hyatt.
Yeah, Ron Pollack is with us. He is the founding executive director of Families USA. The website, of course, familiesusa.org. And Ron, Give our viewers and our listeners an overview of what's going on here.
Well, we have hundreds of people here who are activists from all across the country, and we're talking through what we need to do in the months and year ahead. And the key task at this point, unlike last year when we weren't sure whether the Affordable Care Act would survive Supreme Court challenge,
right,
the presidential election,
yeah,
now we know the Affordable Care Act is going to move forward. And in 11 months, it's going to be implemented. In 8 months, the enrollment period begins so that people who don't have coverage but need coverage can start getting enrolled.
So that's what, September or October?
It starts October 1.
October 1, okay.
And the enrollment, while it starts October 1, applies starting January 1. But it'll take a while for a number of people to get enrolled.
Sure.
So job one that we're all talking about is how do we make sure that the tens of millions of people who don't have coverage, can't afford it, are going to get the help they need, because the Affordable Care Act does provide help, but unfortunately, the overwhelming majority of people are unaware of it. So we've got to undertake a major public education campaign so that everybody who can really benefit from it actually learns about it and gets enrolled. That's job one. Now, we got a number of states, as you know, that have not yet chosen to expand their Medicaid programs,
right,
which is allowed under the Affordable Care Act. And the Affordable Care Act provides very substantial money to the states that choose to do it, 100% of the cost of expanded coverage for the next 3 years.
That's still not a good enough price for Bobby Jindal and Rick Scott.
It's Yeah, that's right. I have a feeling that...
Free is not a good enough price.
The overwhelming majority of governors ultimately are going to say yes. We already have four governors who are Republicans who said yes, and Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, and North Dakota. I think there's going to be another major announcement next week. I think that as states and governors understand that, first of all, it's not going to cost their state money, and it's actually going to save the state money, because remember, when somebody's uninsured, goes to a public hospital and gets care, that costs the state money. Well, it's going to save the state money.
And that, by the way, is a law that Ronald Reagan put into place in the 80s, is that the ERs have to take people in. Before that, they used to throw people out.
That's right. And of course, this is going to mean more jobs. It's going to strengthen the economy, because there's a huge influx of dollars that will come to a state. You know, can you imagine, how does a governor from Louisiana say to his constituents, you're going to be paying federal taxes, and those federal taxes are going to go to provide health coverage for people in California and New York, but you're not going to get it here in Louisiana.
Right.
I don't think, I wouldn't want to try to sell that proposition.
Yeah, Bobby Jindal's going to have a challenge on his hands. And,
you bet.
And Rick Scott and a lot of these other guys. Respectfully, isn't it the job of the Obama administration to inform people of this rather than independent groups like yours? And maybe you should be doing more like advocacy, and or is advocacy and informing people the same thing? As people learn about it, does that get them more excited about it, so they're more likely to get politically active to push back against the attacks on the program? Or am I missing your mission statement?
Well, first let me say, I think the Obama administration is fully committed and will be undertaking a vigorous effort to inform people. Secretary Sebelius, I think, is going to continue to be tireless in going around the country and informing people. So the administration is going to do the job. But this is so big. This is unprecedented. We've never seen such an expansion of coverage. So it really is important for the public and the private sector to do this work. For those of us who've been working literally for decades to try to expand coverage for people that don't have it, well, we won a big victory in 2010 with the Affordable Care Act being passed, but it's only a piece of paper right now.
Yeah.
And we now have to make sure that as the rubber hits the road, people learn about it. So we will be working closely with the Obama administration to make sure people learn about it and actually get enrolled.
Now, there actually are a fair number of pieces of the Affordable Care Act that have already come into law. You know, your kids can be on the program until they're 26. And, well, actually, if you could bring us up to date on what has taken place, what's going to take place, and at what point in time and under what circumstances will the state of Vermont, which has already passed the legislation, been signed by the governor, they got the task force working on it right now for a statewide single-payer health care system, when will they be able to kick that into place? Montana, of course, is looking at the same, and you may know of others, Ron. We're talking with Ron Pollack, by the way, who's the founding executive director of Families USA, who's putting on this conference here.
So there are a number of things that already have taken effect. So you mentioned one of them. Young adults up to their 26th birthday can stay on their parents' policy. There are close to 3 million people, young adults, who have gained coverage that way. Children can no longer be denied health care coverage due to a pre-existing condition. And come January, that protection is going to extend to everybody.
Wow.
So that's very important. So many people who need health care the most may have diabetes or asthma or something that's even more life-threatening. They no longer can be denied insurance,
right,
due to a pre-existing condition. Small businesses are getting tax credit subsidies so that it's affordable to continue providing coverage for their workers. Seniors are receiving benefits. They have this big gap in coverage. They are now getting help with that coverage, and that'll continue. Mm-hmm. They're now getting free preventive care services.
Mm-hmm.
Now the bigger reforms go into effect that enable people to get coverage in a new marketplace and get subsidies for them.
And that starts over the next year or two. And just real quickly, when can Vermont kick in? Is that 2014 or 2016?
I think it's 2016.
Unless they get a waiver from Congress, right?
Yeah. So that's going to be a very important experiment to watch.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I think it could be the Saskatchewan of the United States. Ron Pollack, the founding executive director of Families USA. Thanks, Ron.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. FamiliesUSA.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Check out FamiliesUSA.org for more information. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Families USA Action Health Action 2013 conference. And, you know, we're having a fine old time here. Bob Edgar is here with me, and the head of Common Cause, president and CEO.
That's correct.
That's pretty fancy.
5.5 years I've been at Common Cause.
Wow.
Trying to get control of reforming government.
And formerly a member of Congress. I mean, you know how the sausage is made. And now you're on the outside trying to help make the sausage factory a little more rational place.
Hey, Tom, when I served in Congress, the sausage was made by Democrats and Republicans coming together and cooperating, collaborating, compromising. My best friends were moderate Republicans like Jake Javits, Senator Brooks, Hines and Schweiker from Pennsylvania.
Those were all people of integrity.
Yes. You can find a couple examples of them in a cage next to the panda exhibit at the Washington Zoo.
At the Smithsonian.
I got elected in the most Republican district in the nation to have a Democratic congressman by fiscally conservative Republican men who cared about the environment and fiscally conservative Republican women who cared about women's issues.
Yeah.
And that group of Republicans, the Rockefeller, Eisenhower, Lincoln Republicans, have so been diminished that it's very difficult. And I think for the last 20 years, we've been hurt as a nation trying to solve these complicated issues, including health care. But it's been difficult because of this hyper partisanship that we see in Washington.
Yeah, yeah. We did a show 2-3 weeks ago where we just took the 1956 Republican platform, the platform on which Dwight Eisenhower ran. The Republican Party is proud of the fact that 2.7 million new people have been added to the Social Security eligibility rolls. Over 6 million new Americans have joined unions. I mean, literally, that's how it read. It was quite remarkable.
Superimposed that on his statement about military-industrial complex. And,
yes.
And you've got a political party that no longer exists.
Yes, by and large. I think you're right. The Republican Party of my dad. My dad lived and died a Republican. And
my dad as well. He died at age 56 as a Republican. Maybe we need a national choose-up-sides-again day and have all of the parties redefine themselves.
You know, I get, because this is a call-in show, I get Republicans calling in all the time, and maybe one out of three is actually rational and common sense and actually believes in the principles rather than just sucking up to the billionaire, the plutocrats. And I just beg them, please take back your party. We need a loyal opposition that is sane. To that point, you have been Common Cause. We're talking with Bob Edgar. He's the president and CEO of Common Cause. CommonCause.org, of course, is the website. Common Cause has been working on, I mean, you guys work on all kinds. It's amazing, your portfolio.
We're thriving right now on corruption and bad Supreme Court decisions. Yes. We'd actually like to thrive less.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that you've been working on lately, and I don't know if this is something that you want to get into right now or not, and if not, if you'll just say so, but we thought we had a chance to have the filibuster reformed, and to the best of my knowledge, there still is a chance, and the only chance that there still is out there is you guys with a lawsuit. Do I have that right?
No, that's right. We need one of the senators who are angry about the mini, mini, mini step that was taken last week. Mm-hmm. We use the word capitulation. We think Harry Reid capitulated on the reforms of the filibuster.
Well, Mitch McConnell sent out an email that day saying we beat the liberals. Right. So I
think most Americans don't have a clue how the filibuster has actually damaged democracy. It wasn't in the Constitution, was invented by Aaron Burr, wasn't named a filibuster till 50 years later, was used up till 1970 to protect slavery and lynching laws more than it was used for human rights or civil rights. When Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, the movie in 1939, got nominated for an Academy Award, there were zero filibusters that year. And the guys and men and women who are calling the filibusters represent only 14% of the total population of the United States. And yet they blocked disclosure legislation. The Dream Act was blocked. People don't remember that Medicare, which everybody likes, including some of the Tea Party conservatives, only passed by 55 votes in 1965. So the filibuster, if good legislative agenda issues come forward, gets stymied. And Senator Reid agreed to with a handshake, a wink, and a nod last week is not only pretty small. I think you're going to see within not too distant future the ultra-conservatives using the filibuster to block gun legislation, to reform the gun laws. You're going to see them block issues relating to the debt and the deficit. And even in health care, which is the subject of this particular conference, health care would have been much stronger, much more appropriate.
We'd have a public option if it were.
We would have had a public option, and that would have been much better. In fact, I don't think that the health care law would have gone to the Supreme Court had it been by majority rule. But because they needed 60 votes, they kept stopping good filibuster conversation at the front end, never had it debated on the floor of the Senate until they got 60 votes on a lukewarm, watered-down version. Now, it's the best health care law that we could get given the brokenness of Congress. We need to implement it now, and I hope that the conservatives recognize that one of the lessons of the last election is that Obama won, that the health care is not going to die. You're not going to find enough votes either in the Senate or the House to completely kill it. President's not going to allow the losing of the current law. So let's work together. Let's try to improve it. Let's fix it. Let's teach people how in October 2013 they can sign up for it. It's time to move forward. Social Security works. Medicare works. The new health care law must work. And we need to recognize that health care is a right.
Yeah. And in fact, we're the only developed country in the world that doesn't literally call it a right. We call it a privilege.
That's exactly right.
We're talking with Bob Edgar. CommonCause.org is the website. I'm curious, you mentioned, you know, we had this election. President Obama won. The fact of the matter is that the American people fairly overwhelmingly voted to keep Democrats in charge of the Senate, Democrats in charge of the White House, and they actually, by 1.5 to 2 million vote majority, voted to have Democrats in charge of the House of Representatives. And yet, at this moment, the Republicans control the House of Representatives because of the way that they rigged the game. Now they're talking about rigging the Electoral College so that next time around, not only will they control the House with having lost, but still they won, but they can control the White House. Yeah. Is this part of the Common Cause portfolio?
Absolutely. You may be surprised to know that Common Cause was responsible in California for taking away the ability of the state legislature to draw those districts, and we set up a commission in California, Citizens Commission. They drew the lines. This is the first election that voters got to pick their legislators rather than legislators picking their voters. Right. We hope that that redistricting reform will spread. We're going to work on that.
Is California also the only state that does that?
No, there are a couple states. Iowa is actually the good example of how to redistrict, and there are a couple others that have done it well. Florida is the poster child for how to get it wrong, and we're working with Fair Districts Florida to try to spread that good citizen virus to get a citizen commission. In Florida, the incumbents draw the lines. Very few incumbents ever lose an election because they rig the election for both the Democrats and Republicans. On the issue of the conservatives now moving state by state to change the Electoral College, Common Cause for some time has been for the national popular vote, which is an effort to get an interstate compact, and when enough states agree to it and have 271 electors, then the person who wins the national presidential vote will, in fact, be the president that's
right.
installed.
It kills the Electoral College without amending the Constitution.
That's exactly right. And we think that these efforts that we saw a week or so ago spring up in Virginia, it's now springing up a couple other places. The good news about that is that there are some conservative Republicans who have resisted and pushed back and said they won't support the change. We want to be vigilant and keep watch. We don't think it's going to be a spread across the country, and we hope that people who want to really reform the Electoral College will take a look at the national popular vote as the way to do it.
They have 4 years, and, you know, I'm from Michigan. I pay attention to what's going on there, and Rick Snyder, the governor, came right out and said in a public forum, you know, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. He was opposed to Right for Work for Less legislation. He would fight it. He would prevent it from happening. And less than 80 or 90 days later, he's signing the bill.
Well, I think it's important for us to be vigilant and watch for this. But let me just make one. I happen to be a strong optimist. All of the ultra-conservative efforts through ALEC and through other things to have voter ID laws, to restrict voting, that got pushed back largely by the courts, but also were in the press over the last couple of years, I think it encouraged senior citizens, young adults, persons of color to come out and vote last November.
Mm-hmm.
So I think conservatives ought to be pretty careful about what they're up to, because they may just make voters mad enough that they come back and not only push back on these outrageous decisions, but I think it's going to be hard for particularly the Republican Party to reclaim its core values.
Yeah, and it seems like for the first time in a long time, the press is actually talking about these things. So, Bob Edgar, Common Cause, commoncause.org is the website. Be sure and check it out, and we'll be back. Thank you, Bob.
Take care.
Great having you with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That's CommonCause.org. Check it out. Drop in. Say hi from us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Health Action 2013 Families USA Conference. And Marcia in Smyrna, Georgia. Hey, Marcia. Thanks for holding on the line. It says that there's a school shooting outside of Atlanta. Smyrna is kind of suburban Atlanta. What's going on down there?
Yes, sir. I just turned the television off so I could hear you. Hang on just a second.
I need to check a couple of websites, a couple of news sites here during the break.
Yeah, CNN. I found it first on CNN, and then I just turned on the local affiliate that they were getting their news from. This was not a mass shooting. This was not an outsider. This is a middle school, Price Middle School. And evidently, there was some sort of an altercation. One student was injured with non-life-threatening injuries, and a second, and I think a teacher also had some injuries, but they don't think it was from the gunshot. They think it was from the panic.
Now, here's what's interesting about this, Marcia. I'm looking at the New York Times. There's no mention of it right now. Just check Think Progress, Center for American Progress's blog. They're usually on these things. And then it suddenly hit me. Since Newtown, there have been 15, as of last night when I went to bed, there had been 1,553 gun killings in the United States. So apparently this is not national news, because it's just, hey, it's another day in America.
Yeah.
And
evidently, I just called because I thought you would like to know about it.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the tip and the opportunity to editorialize about it. That this is just another day in America, and I think it's just a tragic thing. So, Marcia, thank you so much for the call and for the heads up.
You're welcome.
And we will keep our eye on that. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. We're live from the Health Action 2013 Families USA Radio Row. It's 3:52 Eastern Time on Thursday here in Chad, listening to WCPT in Chicago, Illinois, where it would be 2:52. Hey, Chad, what's up?
I was listening yesterday when you were talking about Wayne LaPierre, and you mentioned...
Wayne LaPierre.
He was trying to take away some of our liberties with... the background checks. Can you explain that?
I said he's trying to take away our liberties with background checks?
Well, he said that if there was some database, if we saw a psychiatrist, we might be denied something.
Oh, I remember. Yeah. What I was saying was that, first of all, I think that this whole mentally ill thing is a canard. It's a smokescreen. It's a straw man. It's a false argument. The vast majority of murders are not committed by people who are insane. They do not end up in insane asylums. They end up in regular, good old-fashioned prisons. The vast majority of suicides are not committed by people who are insane by any definition. They may be depressed, but that's not the kind of insanity that gets you on a list. And most of these mass shootings are actually suicide on steroids, suicide where they're taking people with them. So, first and foremost, while I am a big fan of mental health being considered the same as kidney health or pancreas health, you know, that we should be treating people who have challenges in their brain or neurochemical imbalances or whatever it may be, the same way we treat people who don't have enough insulin, with our healthcare system. I don't think that the solution to our gun violence problem is to create a giant database of people who've ever visited a psychiatrist and deny them the access to a weapon for any purpose. I think that's crazy.
Is that something that Wayne LaPierre has tried to advance?
Well, no, before 99, he was in favor of a national database, in background checks, whether or not it would include, people who had ever been to a shrink or not. I frankly doubt. But Wayne LaPierre's position right now is, that anybody should be able to buy a gun without any background check simply by buying it in a gun show. So.
Right. Yeah, that needs a change. Okay. Thanks for your feedback.
Sure. You're welcome.
I'm a listener, and thank you so much.
Thanks for the call, Chad. Brian in Denver, yeah. Listening on AM 760. Yeah. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Not a whole lot. Good to speak with you. I just wanted to get back to the healthcare issue and about the governors saying they're not going to accept it or whatever. And I really do think they have that mentality that I forget what you called it. It wasn't Keynesian, but it was I don't know, just for rich people, where it's just for rich people and not for poor and all that.
Oh. Yeah.
I forget what you called it, but.
Yeah. It is Calvinism is the word I use. Now, it doesn't reflect the modern day beliefs of the modern day Calvinistic church or Calvin church or whatever they call it. But, and it actually doesn't reflect what John Calvin said. But for a while, it was the main rationalization around the revolutionary era here in the United States. Yeah,
and I just wanted to add to that a couple of things, but I'll make it quick. One is if you look at the Bible, and I know you've cited this plenty of times on your show, the rich have a hard time getting into heaven.
Yeah.
I have a needle, and you know, if you really look at the
camels
Bible,
and
the
all
rich
that,
people
yep.
aren't on the good side of God. So,
yeah.
I don't even think they know they're on the religious when they start speaking that stuff. And then I wanted to say the reason the governors are like that, at saying no and they're not going to take the money, it's exactly what's been happening for most of my life with these rich doctors and these rich dentists who won't take Medicare as a payment or won't take Medicaid as a payment because they say it doesn't pay enough of their cost or whatever, and it because it gives them a reduced cost. And they want to charge, you know, if you they want to pull your tooth, they want to charge five times what it's worth. They don't want to charge twice what it's worth. That's not enough money for them. They got three homes to pay off, you know.
Yeah.
So I think
in some cases they have some pretty ferocious student loans, but you know, the year that Louise and I lived in Germany, one of the really, really nice things, and we interacted with doctors a number of times. We had three kids, and you know, stuff happens. And it was that all the doctors make a decent pay. I mean, probably the equivalent in today's money of $150,000, maybe $180,000, something like that. But it's not based on how many patients they see or anything like that. They can't kick it up or kick it down. They get a base pay. And so people who go into the business do so because they love medicine. And it's such a difference from people who go into medicine because they want to get rich.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Radio Row at Health Action 2013 of Families USA. And actually, turn down that mic. There we go. Nearly half of all Americans are one financial shock away from poverty. This is a situation that, you know, may seem shocking to a lot of Americans. It's something that, you know, anybody who grew up in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, it would be a surprise to, or not anybody, but for many Americans. However, it has been, A, the history of minority Americans from the beginning, whether it's African Americans or Native Americans or Latinos. But in addition to that, it has also historically been the way it is in America. I mean, you know, with a few exceptions, that period between the 50s and the 80s was an exceptional time in America economically, because Franklin Roosevelt took capitalism and regulated it in such a way that it worked to the advantage of the middle class. And then Lyndon Johnson tweaked it even further so it worked to the advantage of not just the white middle class, but that a black middle class could emerge. And this expectation that that would continue has been with us for a while. Of course, you know, Ronald Reagan put the death nail in it. Nobody realized it took a while. You know, it takes a while for these policies to take place. Roosevelt put most of these policies in place in 35, and it wasn't until the 50s, you know, 15 years later, that we really saw them come to fruition as a generational kind of thing. But this is the latest study to come out of the Corporation for Enterprise Development. Almost half, 43.9% of U.S. households are living on the edge of financial collapse, with almost no savings to fall back on in the event of job loss, health crisis, or other income-depleting emergency. They lack adequate savings. I'm frankly surprised it's that low. I would have expected it was closer to 70 or 80%. But I guess some people still have some equity in their homes, or maybe they didn't calculate that, you know, most people who have equity in their homes actually have a lot of debt in their homes. I don't know. So we'll see how this thing plays out. But this was a very intentional thing. The natural state of capitalism, of raw, unrestrained, brute force, the winner-take-all, monopolistic, tooth-and-fang capitalism, the natural state of that, is to have a very small ruling class, a very small middle class. The ruling class, of course, the very wealthy, the millionaires and the billionaires, the middle class being the you know, typically more of a mercantile class, the people who are the, as the old nursery rhyme went, the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker, the people who own their own small local businesses. And by and large, they've all been put out of business. I mean, when was the last time you walked into a shopping center, a mall, or a downtown, and you saw a locally owned business, if you didn't live in some small town that actually protects them? So anyhow, that used to be the middle class. And then everybody else was the working poor. And the policies that Ronald Reagan put into place were intentionally designed to move people out of the middle class into the working poor. And when I say intentionally designed, I'm not, this isn't some weird conspiracy theory. I'm not just like, you know, coming off on some, you know, tinfoil hat thing, and it's got nothing to do with pigeons. Go back and read the founding book, the seminal book of the modern conservative movement, the Conservative Mind by Russell Kirk. He wrote it in 1951. And, you know, what Russell Kirk wrote was that a middle class, that because people are essentially evil, this is the core belief of conservatives, because people are essentially evil, they will steal whatever they can get. And so if you have a middle class, a large middle class that is able to vote and participate in voting, they will look at all the money that the wealthy people have and they'll say, we'll figure out a way to steal that. We will vote ourselves more and more benefits. We'll vote ourselves Social Security. We'll vote ourselves unemployment benefits. We'll vote ourselves a minimum wage. And now, up until actually forever, the middle class has voted those things to themselves, but they've always been reasonable. And typically, the middle class has also said, you know, by the way, we'll pay for it ourselves. We'll pay the damn Social Security taxes and Medicare taxes. We'll pay unemployment insurance. Or we'll, you know, our employer will pay it, but, you know, we'll see it taken out of our paycheck. We'll pay for our own pension. But the conservatives were certain that if that middle class got power, the day would come when it would be the Bastille all over again. It would be the terrors, Maximilian Robespierre and the guillotine. And, you know, prior to that and after that, they would, the middle class would steal everything they could. And the proof of this, by the way, Russell Kirk in the 1950s predicted that if the middle class became as strong as they did in the 60s, keep in mind, if the minimum wage in 1968 were inflation adjusted to today, it would be $10.50 an hour, which still ain't much, but people can live on that in most parts of the country. Not super well, but it's better than $7.25. But what Russell Kirk predicted was that if that middle class got strong, if kids could go to college without being in perpetual debt, if people could, you know, with a high school diploma, get a decent job in a factory and raise their family and put their kids through college, if that middle class got strong, then what you would see were revolts. He predicted revolution. And sure enough, women were burning their bras and wanting equal say in place and power in the workplace, and gays, the Stonewall riot, gays were starting to stand up and say, hey, wait a minute, we're part of the American family here. Minorities, African Americans were saying, hey, what about us? We keep getting left behind. We'd like to be part of this train. Students were saying, hell no, I won't go to Vietnam, to the point where they had to bring out the National Guard and kill four of them in Ohio. Ronald Reagan, by the way, a week before, referred to them as brats and did away with free college. I mean, you know, he said, you know, why should I pay for these brats to be going to college? And they would disagree with my policies. So what you're looking at right now, with roughly half of Americans being literally one paycheck away from homelessness and disaster, is the natural state. It's the natural state of tooth and claw, laissez-faire, unrestrained, libertarian, Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged capitalism. It's the natural state of it. It naturally produces monopolies. It naturally produces a small mercantile middle class. The doctors, the lawyers, are this era's version of the butcher and the baker. And it naturally produces a large working poor. And by reducing so many of us to the working poor, what the Reagan conservatives have succeeded in doing is exactly what Russell Kirk predicted. He said, hey, you know, if the middle class gets strong, this was in 51, he wrote the book. He said, if the middle class gets strong, as they did in the 60s and 70s, they're going to stand up and demand things. And they did. And that social unrest, to many of us, that was a good sign. When Jefferson saw social unrest, he thought it was a good thing. He thought that was cultural evolution. Conservatives see social unrest and they think, uh-oh, this is bad. Stability is to be valued above all other things. And then Kirk basically said, so the solution to this is to wipe out that middle class. To make those people poor again so that they will not be that pesky middle class demanding all those rights and demanding all those privileges and, oh my God, they want Social Security and Medicare. How dare they? And that's where we are now with half of Americans, one paycheck away from absolute, utter, total disaster. We'll be back in just a minute. It is 15 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program. Broadcasting.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Broadcasting live from Health Action 2013, Families USA's Radio Row. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And you just heard my rant. Dan Weber is on the line with us. He's the founder of the Association of Mature American Citizens, AMAC, AMAC.US. Dan, welcome.
Great to talk to you, Tom. Thanks for having me on your great show.
What makes a person mature?
I guess you feel like you've finally grown up. You and I've got a way to go. Hey, I got to ask you something.
Sure.
It's been very cold in New York. It's been so cold. Now, you're supposed to say how cold.
How cold is it, Dan?
It's been so cold that I actually saw a liberal politician with his hands in his own pockets.
Bum bump. So what's wrong with a little socialism? The democratic socialist countries of the world, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Denmark, Germany, the countries that openly and proudly, Iceland, openly and proudly call themselves democratic socialist, are doing the best of all the countries on earth. Their quality of life is higher, their lifespan is longer, their people are happy, they're not having the mass murders that we're having, they don't have homeless people, they don't have people dying of diseases that could have been prevented. What the hell's wrong with a little bit of socialism?
Yeah, I actually think a little bit of socialism isn't the problem. It's when you have a lot of socialism. You know, I heard your rant before, which wasn't a rant. It was actually a thoughtful, driven diatribe.
Well, it was a summary of
yeah.
Russell Kirk's book that was the founding document for Barry Goldwater and William F. Buckley, who I knew.
You quoted Ayn Rand, and lot of us conservatives, we don't read out of the same hymn book as she does.
Yeah.
But I understand. But you were saying about how conservatives want to do away with the middle class, and the truth is the conservatives' goal is to have a huge middle class. The conservatives want to do away with class, and our president wants to establish these sharp lines and separate us by class.
So you want to do away with class. Are you suggesting that the Koch brothers, who are sitting on $50 billion, should take, say, $49 billion of that?
More so than Soros. So let's talk down.
Okay, are you saying that George Soros, who's sitting on $3 or $4 billion, should give all but $1 billion of it to what? The Social Security Fund?
I don't think anybody should tell them where to give the money except themselves. You know, let me tell you, but you talked about big, giant corporations. A guy named Judson Branch, he started Allstate. And I was at a meeting, I was an Allstate agent years ago, and he stood up and he said, if profit is the heart of a business, then social responsibility should be its soul. That was the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, and that's what most true conservatives believe in. We have
well,
a social obligation.
That's what, you know, Barry Goldwater believed in. That's what Everett Dirksen believed in. That's what my dad and Dwight Eisenhower believed in.
Yes.
That is not Dan Weber, and you know it as well as I do. That is not what Mitch McTurtle, whatever his name is, believes in. That's not what John Boehner believes in. These guys are are, you know, they're basically toadies for billionaires.
I actually think their biggest problem isn't that. It's just that they got to have a little more courage and show a little more leadership. We've got to solve
what does that mean?
Problems.
Well, give me an example.
Social Security. I've met with people on Harkin's staff, Liberal Democrat. I've met with people on Hatch's staff, Conservative Republican. They both want to solve the Social Security problem. There's nobody leading on either side
of the problem?
That it's not solvent.
What? The Social Security is fine. It's got $2.7 trillion in its trust fund.
In 2016, the disability fund, the trust fund is going to run out of money.
2027.
No, we're talking the disability segment.
Okay.
That's 30% of Social Security.
So why don't we just, you're right, it is about a third of Social Security. Why don't we simply, you know, conservatives love flat taxes. Why don't we make the Social Security tax a flat tax? Why should it be a tax that only falls on people who make under $113,000? Why is it that somebody who makes $15,000 a year, they're below the level of poverty, they're living on cat food?
You're an intelligent man, and there's no reason why that can't be negotiated. Along with, how about this? In 2008, 2009, there was no increase in Social Security because there was no COLA, even though the gas went up $1 a gallon. AMAC's proposal on Social Security is to give a minimum 1.65 increase, no matter what COLA is, even if it says it's zero, to low-income Americans. So that's a conservative idea. That's not a liberal idea.
Oh, wait a minute. There's a poison pill in there, and that's the too low-income Americans. Why not give it to everybody? Because it sounds to me like what you're trying to do is turn Social Security into a welfare program.
A page out of the president's book here. The upper-income folks, if they get a 1.65 instead of a 3% increase, by the way, we're capping higher income people at 1.65.
Why?
Those two things will make, why? To make it solvent.
No.
So the last 80
the total years, number of wealthy people who are taking Social Security, you know, you could fill a large ballroom here in Washington, D.C. with. It's an irrelevant number of people. What you guys are trying to do is you're trying to turn Social Security into a welfare program because you know that welfare programs, when Americans say, oh, we're going to cut welfare, everybody goes, yeah, okay, cool, do that. You know, to hell with poor people. But, you know, you say you're going to cut Social Security. Oh, no, we're not going to do that. So let's do it piece by piece. Let's start with the rich people, and then we'll redefine the rich people as those making over $100,000 a year, and then we'll define it as those making over 50.
Do away with those class discrimination things.
Yeah, I don't believe it. That sounds to me like weasel words. Respectfully, Dan.
I understand where you're coming from. We have a different point of view, that's for sure.
So how do you get rid of class?
How do you get rid of class?
You said you want to get rid of class, but you don't want to take money away from billionaires. The two things don't seem to be.
What you do is what Reagan said. You raise the tide and everybody's boat goes up. What conservatism does, it gives people jobs.
Reagan cut taxes on rich people, doubled taxes on working people, and borrowed $2.5 trillion to create a bubble economy. You're suggesting we should do that?
That's what the president suggested. That's what Nancy Pelosi said.
No, they're not suggesting that at all. They're not suggesting Reaganomics. Nobody is suggesting Reaganomics.
Let's forget about the past and talk about the future. Let's talk about some new ideas. How about getting both sides of the aisle together and solving these things piece by piece?
Well, because the Republican side of the aisle is run by crazies and they don't want to talk. They'd rather grandstand.
You know, they
want to turn Social Security over to the guys on Wall Street because, hey, there's $2.7 trillion. Imagine what you can scale off the rack. But, Dan, we're going to have to live to debate this another day. Check out AMAC, AMAC.us, the Association of Mature American Citizens. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Good
talking to you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we'll be back with more. Your calls, my thoughts, rants of the day, a few guests here and there from the Health Action 2013 conference. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Health Action 2013 Families USA conference in Washington, D.C., surrounded by talk show hosts you can hear in the background. And I guess we have a senator who may be dropping by. I'm not sure exactly. Schedules are fluid, as they say. So let's pick up some calls here. Robert in Augusta, Georgia. Hey, Robert, thanks for watching us on DirecTV. What's up?
Well, thanks, Tom, for your show. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, good. I wrote my last will and testament the other night. I owe much, I own nothing. Give the rest to the poor. But anyway.
You and a lot of Americans, you know, tragically.
I got a book in front of me. It was written in 1980 by Alexander Paris.
Mm-hmm.
It's called The Coming Credit Collapse. Have you heard about that one?
No, but it makes perfect sense. You know,
yes,
in 1980,
really
you could really see it happening.
In 1980, there was an update. But basically, the problem is the intervention of the government into the private sector. And to finance this intervention, it created credit and money to finance it.
Yeah, well, that's nothing new.
That's why we have a $16 trillion debt.
Yeah, that's nothing new. We've had, you know, we've always created money by creating debt. We have a debt-based monetary system, which I agree with Ellen Brown, I think is wrong.
This is the tax and debt slaves, basically. Let me give you a quote of Thomas Jefferson, and I'll leave you.
Sure.
I place economy among the first and most important virtues, and public debt as the greatest of dangers. We must make our choice between economy and liberty, or profusion and servitude.
Yeah, and then he goes on to talk about if we don't, we will end up with the shackles around our necks like the British have put around their people. So, yeah. Robert, I'm familiar with the quote. It's a good one. And actually, there's a couple pieces to it. It can be interpreted a number of different ways. Have a seat, Senator. Great to have you with us. Senator Richard Blumenthal is with us. He is a U.S. Senator from Connecticut. Do I have that right?
Absolutely.
And let's see here, blumenthal.senate.gov, of course, your website. You, sir, I understand, are introducing legislation to have not only background checks, but something to do with ammunition. Can you tell us about that?
Exactly right. I've supported Senator Feinstein's bill to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines and have helped to lead the effort in that area, but also better background checks for firearms.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, it's against the law for felons, fugitives, the dangerously mentally ill, as well as domestic abusers, to buy both firearms and ammunition.
Right.
And there are background checks for 60%. There should be universal background checks for firearm purchases, but none whatsoever for ammunition. So yeah. I propose that we have basic background checks as a simple, common-sense law enforcement tool so we keep ammunition out of the hands of people like the shooter in Newtown,
yeah,
who massacred 26 wonderful people.
Yeah, you know, the old, it used to be guns kill people, and then the NRA said, no, guns don't kill people, people kill people. But the truth is, ammunition kills people.
Bullets kill people.
Yeah, bullets
at the end of the day, you
yeah.
can't kill someone without bullets and ammunition. And this idea came to me from the people who know most about this subject, in my view, which is the law enforcement community. The police and prosecutors have said to me, you know, all this other stuff's fine, but at the end of the day, bullets are what kill people. And that's why we need background checks on the massive purchases of ammunition that go on day in and day out.
Sales on the internet.
You're a convicted felon. You're a fugitive.
I am none of the above.
A domestic abuser.
For the record.
Not you personally, but if you were, you could walk into a Walmart, not to pick on Walmart. It's been
sure.
responsible.
Well, they're the largest seller of guns and ammunition in the country.
Buy a shopping cart full of ammunition, literally, pay for it, walk out, no questions asked.
Yeah. And there's something fundamentally wrong with that. I remember some years back, it seems like it was in the last decade and a half or so, when the cop killer bullets were quite the rage, and there was legislation to try to stop they called them cop killer bullets. They were basically bullets that could, two types, one that could penetrate a bulletproof vest, and the second that basically exploded once they get inside the body, the hollow points, and distribute the force over a wider area. So rather than just injuring a muscle, they'll just kill a body. And my recollection is that both those kinds of ammunition are still available, and by virtue of the good services of the National Rifle Association. Am I right about that? And if so, what possible rationale would they have for wanting cop killer bullets when we don't use those? I'm a sports shooter. I don't need a cop killer bullet to put, you know, to put a bullet through a piece of paper that's a 16th of an inch thick or less. I have friends who are hunters. You don't use cop killer bullets to take down a deer or a pheasant. And frankly, I think if somebody was breaking into my house, I'd rather hit them with a shotgun with birdshot, which would disable them. But if I'm a not particularly good shot, I'd have a much higher probability of hitting them than try and hit them with a bullet, which could miss them by a few inches, and now they're still coming at me. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, on the cop killer bullet, my bill would actually ban Teflon-tipped bullets and incendiary bullets, which in effect explode on impact. The Teflon bullets go through armor. So both are designed to disable the armor that police wear.
Right.
And, by the way, as a footnote here, I spoke to our state police right after the Newtown killing, and they told me that their armor could not stop the assault weapon used by the killer there.
Yeah, not much could. I mean, these are battlefield weapons.
But here we're talking about bullets that are designed especially to pierce that armor, and that's why my bill would ban them.
Right.
The reason they're not banned now is very simply that the law that contained the present provisions was incomplete and defective, and we need to update it.
Right.
But I would also say about those ammunition purchases that this bill would apply to all ammunition purchases as long as somebody, you're a sports shooter, if you have a pistol permit or a hunting license, background check has already been done on you.
Right.
And if you present that...
buy your ammunition.
You can buy the ammunition, and if there has to be a check, it's less than 30 seconds to do the check. It's called an instant background check for a reason. It goes to the National Criminal Background Check System, NICS, as it's called, instantaneously, electronically. It's less than 30 seconds.
Well, it's like the checks they do before you get in an airplane. It's yes, no.
Even quicker.
You don't even need all that data. It's just, it's basically yes, no. I'm curious, in his testimony before Congress yesterday, or perhaps it was the day before, Wayne LaPierre essentially said that, and echoed the sentiments that I've had a number of people come on this program and share, that even though all the evidence contradicts it, I've actually read the debates on the Second Amendment, I've read the Federalist Papers, and I've read the Virginia Ratifying Convention, which is where Mason and Madison and Patrick Henry had the largest and loudest disagreement about the Second Amendment. Nobody ever mentioned taking down the government of the United States, ever. I can tell you that with absolute assurance, and they will never be able to quote that. If anything, they were looking at protecting this country they had just created, not even imagining that they would someday take it down. But Wayne LaPierre's position is that someday the government may become so tyrannical that we have to start shooting at senators, congressmen, police officers, firefighters, you know, our government. We the people. This insane notion that we the people, we create this government, and then somehow it becomes so crazy that we have to kill it. Where's this virus coming from? What are your thoughts on that? Because if you actually hold to that logic, then cop killer bullets actually make sense, because someday the cops are going to come and get you. I mean, I get it. It's the David Koresh Waco logic, but there's a lot of people who think this way.
I might be able to give you a better informed answer if I were a psychiatrist or, you know, if my degree were other than a juris doctor, a lawyer. But I see it as, in a certain way, an extension of a, almost maybe a paranoiac thread in American culture or in the American populace. Maybe it's always been there. You know, you can go back in history and probably identify the strains of somewhat delusional...
Well, it pops up every now and then, things like the KKK.
Yeah, but, you know, it has been discredited. It's not the basis for the Second Amendment right that I respect, which is people have an individual right to possess a firearm. The Supreme Court has said it.
Right.
You, as a recreational shooter, and now I'm saying you personally.
Yeah, because I am.
You in the abstract,
yeah.
Exactly. But anybody listening who enjoys target shooting, hunting, there's a right for you to have a firearm.
Yeah.
That right is not absolute. No right is. First Amendment is not absolute.
Can't you all fire in a crowded theater?
All of it's subject to reasonable accommodation. It, you know, I hate using the word regulation, but reasonable restriction.
Well, the word regulation only occurs in the Bill of Rights or in any of the amendments in the Second Amendment. So
right.
I think it's
the
appropriate word.
Often the amendments come up against each other. You know, the great tensions and the great genius of our Constitution is that it makes allowances for these potential frictions between rights that are in the abstract, the Second, the First, the Tenth, and also rights of individuals.
And the practical realities of life.
But the point here is there is a Second Amendment right. I don't view it as a right to take shots at police. And neither, by the way, does Chief Johnson of Baltimore, who was there yesterday and who had no use for that.
Hang on, just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Senator Richard Blumenthal with us, United States Senator from Connecticut, Blumenthal.Senate.gov. Thank you so much, sir, for being with us.
Thank you.
Great having you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Health Action 2013 Families USA Radio Row. And what a hoot. We've got a Democratic strategist, Bob Wiener, who's supposed to be with us. Bob Wiener, yeah, we're ready if he wants to show up. And so he's apparently making his way over. But on his way over, Dalen in Los Angeles. Hey, Dalen, thanks for listening to SiriusXM in Los Angeles. What's on your mind today?
Hey, thanks for having me. This is a really great conversation. And you mentioned something a minute ago, or you were having a conversation about salary and wealth and what is and isn't wealthy. I just want to say for the record, I'm liberal, I'm married, I'm openly gay, and you know what, I'm fully employed. So on some instances I consider myself lucky, and others I don't, but you know, I was a student, and I owe about $150,000 in student loans, and my monthly payment's $1,200 a month. I support my spouse, and we don't make enough. Like, and I make close to that $100,000 number that you mentioned, and you would think that that's enough, but I mean, we live in, just like everybody else, we can barely put away for savings. It's hand to mouth.
Yeah, no, it is just plain old flat out insane. First of all, that anybody in the United States should graduate from college in debt. You know, we're pretty much the only country in the world that does that. And we didn't do that until after the Reagan Revolution. Reagan was the one who ended free college in California. And then he put Bob Bennett in charge of the Department of Education, the guy who said, let's do away with the Department of Education, and started the process of killing it off in the United States. So Dayton, or Dalen, thank you very much for the call. I think you make a very, very good and important point. Bob Wiener just showed up here. He is a Democratic strategist and a national columnist, major newspapers, former Clinton White House senior staff, and boy, quite a CV. He worked with the drug czar, Barry McCaffrey, Congressman John Conyers, Charlie Rangel, Claude Pepper. He must have been an amazing guy to hang out with.
We abolished mandatory retirement, brought in Colonel Sanders Wilgear to make end mandatory retirement as the law of the land,
right,
and protected Social Security and Medicare. That was a great experience.
God bless you. Well, as a Democratic strategist, as somebody who you know, offers advice to these folks and has a sense of what's going on, what do you see as the biggest issues facing the Democratic Party right now that really Democrats should be attending to in terms of messaging and action?
Tom, I always love doing your show. I think Obama's gotten a bad rap. He's handled the big issues. He has done it. I'm wearing, for our listeners' benefit, a Roosevelt tie with pictures of Franklin Roosevelt all over, because I believe that historians will say, when the bias is thrown out from the people that, just for reasons that we don't want to say on the air, are against the president, when you look at the fact that he did health care, he ended the Iraq war, the Afghanistan war, you just had a guy on college, he cut college interest rates in half and took it away from the private financing. He saved saved the economy from the abyss and the banks and made the auto company number one in the world again. And he got bin Laden, which the previous administrations couldn't do. When you look at all of that and you add it up, and especially the health care, which is what we're here for today, that is a Rooseveltian set of accomplishments. He has to protect that legacy going into the second term, plus deal with gun control. I was at the announcement at the White House with the president and Biden. And the economy and jobs and protect health care, immigration, deal on the world stage with the looming crises that are going to happen in Iran and Syria, North Carolina,
so
North Korea, and who knows where else,
no,
Africa.
I get it that there's a lot. He's done a lot.
And there's a lot to do.
Some would argue, Roosevelt had his fireside chats. He sat every week with Americans and said, here's what I'm up to.
And Obama has his weekly TV, internet, and radio.
But nobody seems to pay attention to that.
Well, I do, but okay.
Yeah, but, you and I mean, I do too, but you and I are wonks for this stuff.
Yeah, right.
Well, I'd urge the reality is that a third of Americans watched Roosevelt.
Right.
We got nothing like that audience now.
Yeah, but you know what? 70 million Americans watched the presidential debates. And that first one was a disaster, but the second two were fantastic.
Yeah, but that's once every 4 years.
Right.
How can the Democratic Party... In my mind, the major meme is...
They watch the State of the Union.
Society.
They watch the inaugural address. They will watch his speeches
I get that.
Sorry.
In my mind, the main differentiating meme that can be easily communicated is a we society versus a me society.
And Obama made that point in the inaugural address when he said, Social Security and Medicare aren't weakening factors for our country. They are ones that make us great as a society. And these people are not takers. They are makers.
Right.
That was great.
Yeah.
That was fantastic that he got there.
It
took a while to get him there.
It did. It took 4 years.
Yeah.
And do you see that? Are you seeing a significant change in this administration?
Yes, because he was so burned by the compromise, schmoozing, play golf with Boehner strategy last time that, in fact, he's now being more forceful on his morals, on his values, and what we stand for. And the Social Security and Medicare...
Then why didn't he kick Harry Reid's ass over the... And not just Harry Reid. There were seven or eight other senators who actually... Arguably, whether Harry Reid wanted the filibuster change or not, who made it impossible.
Yeah,
why didn't he take names and kick butt?
He should have. We've all I've written op-eds in Roll Call and other places on the fact that the filibuster, which Lyndon Johnson had one of, and now Reid has 144 of against him. That had to be changed. So that obstructionism is outrageous. But I do think the Republicans have learned, and on the fiscal cliff deal, they allowed a majority of Democrats and a minority, less votes for their own leadership party, to allow the country to go forward without letting the country go off the cliff. So maybe they have realized the results of the election. And on immigration, the same thing, Tom. I think they realized the results of the election. Self-deportation is not a policy.
Right. I agree. And we have just a little less than a minute here. We're talking with Bob Wiener.
See, I was racing ahead thinking we only did have the minute. I thought I was done. Go ahead.
We got maybe 20 seconds. Yeah. I don't know. But just to wrap it up, do you think that people should be working inside the Democratic Party, or they should be working in movement politics outside the Democratic Party to move this president?
Great debate. I went to Oberlin, and I decided to be treasurer of the Young Democrats by working inside, but many of my classmates were the protesters and the bomb throwers and the surround the recruiters, cars people on the outside. Both work. Both are critical. The inside, I like the inside strategy because you can make more changes.
Yeah. I'm really fond of the inside-outside that Progressive Democrats of America, Tim Carpenter's doing. You know, he does the outside strategy, and then every month they come to D.C. and basically lobby.
Right.
You know, but and they brought Raul Grijalva and some of these folks in. So.
Well, Grijalva's a great guy.
He is.
Good job as Progressive Caucus.
Bob Wiener, is there a website for you that people should know about?
Yes, all of our op-eds.
WienerPublic.com.
Right, and all of our op-eds on all the major papers are there. www.wienerpublic.com.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Get the right picture for you. And, whew, boy, things go flying by. Yeah, we're broadcasting live from the Health Action Conference 2013, Families USA putting it on. And let's see, we got a bunch of people who've been on the phone here. Dwayne in Petaluma, California. Hey, Dwayne, what's on your mind? You want to talk about sellout senators?
Yeah, I'd like to. I have failed to find the names of the seven that sold us out and basically didn't voted for the other side and didn't hold Harry Reid's feet to the fire to insist that he do the right thing and abolish the silent filibuster.
Yeah.
Side. Is there names? You have their names that you can post on your.
There was one. First of all, Carl Levin was the ringleader, and he's quite public about that. Somebody called and asked Bernie about this last Friday, and Bernie said, you know, Carl Levin was the guy who was negotiating with John McCain and making no bones about it, so you can talk to him. Jeff Merkley, there was an article in one of the, it was either Talking Points memo or Politico, you know, one of these kind of insider web publications, that the day of the filibuster debate that talked about how Jeff Merkley was finding himself on the outside looking in because in a phone conference with a progressive group that he held, a teleconference, he had named seven or eight senators and said, you ought to call these senators and put some pressure on them. These are the guys who are wavering. And I don't remember that list of names. I didn't write it down at the time because I just figured, hey, you know, there it is. This is going to be big news. This is going to be all over. This will be repeated 20 different times. And I never saw it again. And Bernie passed on the opportunity to name more than just the one. He may not have known because he wasn't part of that. You know, I mean, he's not a Democrat. And so, frankly, I don't know the names of who those people were. So, sorry, Dwayne.
Okay, can I make a comment on one other earlier topic?
Sure.
You're talking about overthrowing the government, the Second Amendment, and it would seem to me that most of those people would want to defend themselves as restoring our government from takeover by the 1%.
Yeah, if anything, there is a system built into the U.S. Constitution to overthrow the current U.S. government. It's called elections. And you know, we need to wake up and smell the roses here. Dwayne, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Lawrence in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Lawrence, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? This is your time, man.
Thank you for watching or listening.
I'm gonna name off a few things, and I got a question for you. You remember Valerie Plame, the CIA agent that was outed?
Yeah, by Dick Cheney.
I don't know who it was, Dick Cheney, right, by the government. The Kennedy.
It wasn't the government. It was one corrupt man in the government.
Okay, in the government, okay. And so you can have corrupt people in the government. You got JFK, you got MLK, the story's really behind it, not the surface story. Bobby Kennedy, Malcolm X, 9/11, the ship that they blew up in Vietnam that started the war.
Yeah,
and they laid on
in the Gulf of Tonkin, yeah.
Exactly. WMD, so forth. With this type of action coming from the government, don't you understand why people are afraid to give up their guns? And why should we, I'm actually not a gun owner, but why should we give up our guns? Or why should we be paranoid or disso or crazy because we have this fear of a government? We have a government, either we have two governments or we have a government that makes a habit out of consistently lying and deceiving us and taking us for granted.
It's a good and fairly complex question that you're presenting in a pretty simple fashion. If you believe that all the people that you just named were killed by the government, and for the record, I don't, but although I think that there was government complicity in some of those, and certainly the government was not treating Martin Luther King well, the FBI following him around, trying to discredit him, things like that. But nonetheless, if you believe that,
do you really think that the best way to fix that is to go guns blazing into a government office building?
Oh, no, not at all. And I'm not against the government, not at all. And we should do something to control.
So what do you need that gun for?
Okay, I'm dealing with two sides of the coin. I understand we need control and so forth. But also, I always try to consider both sides of the coin. And I do understand a lot of people's fear of the government. And if the government needs to be aware that they're implicit in causing some of this reaction in their actions. You understand where I'm going?
As I said, we built into our government, or the people who put together the Constitution, built into the government a way to change the government, and it's called elections. And if you don't like the way things are going, I would say, you know, get inside the Democratic Party or get outside the Democratic Party, one or the other. In other words, get into movement politics and be loud and participate and help be the change. Good things have come out of our government as well as bad things. In fact, frankly, I think a lot more good than bad. And the good things that have come out have not come out because somebody decided to take a shot at an ATF agent or stockpile guns down in Waco, Texas. The good stuff that has come about either because people decided that they were going to occupy something, like in 1929, 1930, 31, 32, when those people occupied the lawn of the White House all the way down to the Potomac River, the Bonus Army, or when Martin Luther King and others, occupied the Pettus Bridge in Selma and on and on and on. These were times when people stood up without guns. I don't know of any time in American history when people stood up with guns and anything good came out of it. The only one that I know of that's a big one that everybody knows about is the Civil War, and that didn't work out so well, frankly, for anybody.
Agreed.
Yeah.
But Tom, so, let me ask you something. When I understand what you're saying. We need to get out. We need to vote. I do my part.
Not just vote. Voting is the smallest of all the things.
Exactly. But I want to focus on voting because here you got a group of people, the Republicans. We go around the world. We fight to give people freedom, and then we come home and you can't. They're shutting freedom down over here, okay? And then they come up with this problem, voter ID. Well, it seems like to me, and you say vote, the real problem is not voter ID. The real problem is the fact that you can tamper with and change the software in these machines, change the count. So they're dealing with a problem. You got the government, all these congressmen and so forth, and senators saying, let's do voter ID. Well, how about focusing on the machines that can be jimmied?
Yeah. Well, I don't disagree that there's a machine there. And once again, I mean, look at the Tea Party. They took over the Republican machine. Now, you can argue whether it's a good thing for the country or for the Republican Party, but they did it. And I would submit to you that we need to be taking over the Democratic Party machine. It's a multi-billion-dollar machine, and it's all volunteer, or largely volunteers.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So you call up your local Democratic Party office and you say, I'd like to volunteer. I'd like to become a precinct committee person. I want to show up. Tell me when the meetings are. Tell me what to do. They'll tell you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from Washington, D.C., the Radio Row at the Health Action 2013 Families USA Conference. And Dr. James R. Kimmy is with me, a Master of Public Health and an MD, and a Professor Emeritus and Executive in Residence at the St. Louis University College for Public Health and Social Justice. Sir, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Tom. We're glad to be here.
What do you see as the biggest issues right now facing the Affordable Care Act and the implementation of it?
Well, I think the biggest issue is the implementation. We have the legislation. It's the law of the land. There are a lot of things that need to be done at the state level, at the community level, in order to make it really work. And it's critical to make it work because if we don't, there'll be a backsliding away from universality. And really, the Affordable Care Act should be a step toward universal coverage for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Isn't a large part of that going to be informing people that starting in October they could sign up for this program and getting them on and with the program, and that for probably
a significant portion of America, I hope it's not 47%, God forbid, they can get it for basically free, or there'll be government subsidies for them?
Well, there'll be government subsidies up to 400% of poverty. So, it's a good deal. The problem is, or one of the problems is, that there are two kinds of people out there. There are people who, when they react to the Affordable Care Act, they're those who don't understand it, and that's most of the public, and they're those who don't want it to succeed, and that's a good part of the politicians. So you've got this dynamic of we really need to be informing the public. What they're getting, or they've been getting, is sort of a menu of slogans that are against the Affordable Care Act,
right,
and not a lot of facts about the things that are going to happen and the things that already have happened, is with the kids up to 26 being covered under their parents, pre-existing conditions for children are gone. A lot of good things have happened, but they're not really getting communicated very well.
How do you respond to the Fox News message that they're careful to pound in literally every day, or virtually every day, that once the Affordable Care Act goes into effect, employers will dump all their employees off. The employees will be able to pick up health care for $95 a month, the tax, the fee. If somebody gets sick, they can pick up insurance for the time that they're sick, and when they're not sick anymore, they can drop the insurance. And that's a messy free-for-all, and everybody's going to game the system.
Well, people try to game the system. I think there are many things built into the regulations that are coming out now around the Affordable Care Act that keep you from gaming the system in the ways that you've described. Certainly those are counterproductive. The idea that someone can go bare and then when they get sick get insurance, that's not going to wash. I just don't think, there's no insurer that's going to want to sell them insurance.
But it's legal, isn't it?
Well, but. If they're coming in sick and they have refused to take insurance, I think that that's one of the things, and that will be adjusted over time. If that sort of thing happens, then there are going to be changes. The Affordable Care Act's not perfect. It's full of compromises, like most legislation that comes out of this town. And I think that over time, as we have with many other kinds of legislation, we're going to see adjustments made as people try to game the system.
Sure. For that $950 a year or $90 a month or whatever it is, that penalty that you pay, the tax that you pay if you choose not to have health insurance, do you get anything? Do you get any coverage? Are people covered, or are they just, they're just,
it's
you know,
a penalty. It's a penalty for refusing to take coverage. And, it's a financial penalty, but people that refuse to take coverage should really think about what they're doing in larger terms, community terms, not only their own health. But if they refuse coverage and end up going to the emergency room for their treatment, they are transferring their personal responsibility, of which Fox likes to talk a lot, they're transferring that personal responsibility to the community through insurance premiums for other people, through government programs. So, there's an element of personal responsibility in this that is responsibility to behave responsibly.
Right. I was in India once in the airport in Hyderabad, and there was some guy just coughing his guts out into a wastebasket, and about a quarter of the population there is infected with TB, some fairly large number. Only about 10% of them are contagious, but it was like a petri dish. It had, somebody had dropped a little bit of antibiotic on it. There was this perfect circle around this guy. Nobody would come closer than 50 feet to him. Everybody knew what was going on. Isn't that the sort of thing that happens in countries that don't have universal coverage? And isn't that why we should try to make that $950 a year penalty have some sort of basic coverage associated with it?
Things like that happen in this country. You don't have to go to countries that don't have coverage.
Because we don't have coverage.
It's not quite as dramatic as the 50-foot circle. But, there are a lot of people who are out there not getting treatment because they don't have insurance that are spreading conditions, spreading disease. This, how we can say that, even though we have the Affordable Care Act and we're going to cover, another, 30-some million people, we're leaving 11 million uninsured, undocumented workers sitting out there. That is a public health issue, you see.
Right. Setting aside the morality, it's a public health issue.
Yeah.
So what do we do about it?
Well, I think we have to, I think that's part of the adjustment I see going forward. We're going to have to cover people who represent a threat to the public health, not because they're threatening people, but because they're going to have conditions that can be spread if they're not treated.
Sure. And as, you know, so many of these conditions become, you know, more nasty, these bugs pick up virulence.
Yeah.
You know.
No, Affordable Care Act is a tremendous opportunity. It's a step on a road. We've been on that road since 1912 when Teddy Roosevelt suggested universal coverage. And we're going to reach, you know, we're going to, with the implementation of this, then we're taking another step towards what we really need, which is universal coverage for everybody.
How does Massachusetts, I mean, they're the prototype. How do they handle people who don't hire in? Do they, if somebody gets sick, it shows up at the hospital.
Well, you know, Massachusetts is 97% covered. I mean, there's just not many people out there, so I'm not quite sure what they do with that 3%.
So all those freeloaders that Fox is hysterical about just by and large don't exist. I mean, it's just,
they're not.
Okay. Well said. Dr. James R. Kimmey, MD, MPH, St. Louis University College for Public Health and Social Justice. Sir, it's an honor and a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you very much for being with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with more from the Health Action 2013 Families USA Radio Row right here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from Health Action 2013, Families USA, the Radio Row here at the Hyatt in Washington, D.C. And it's an interesting time as we see the reality of this health care program being implemented and the hiccups in it and the Hannitys and Van Susterns of the world going, oh, it's just terrible, it's gonna be, and others saying, hey, you know, it's a first step down the road to making a better and more civil society, a healthier society, and a society, frankly, where we all have a little more money in our pocket because we're not spending $10,000 per person on health care. Instead, we'd be spending more like $5,000 or $6,000. I mean, ultimately, not with this plan, but as we go down the road, the rest of the world is spending between $5,000 and $6,000. The developed world, we're spending twice that. It's crazy. It's just absolutely crazy. Al in St. Louis. Hey, Al, what's on your mind today?
Yes, Tom. I don't understand. I guess that's kind of a weak, not really what I'm trying to say. It makes me angry when I hear people talk about this government like it's some secretive military junta behind the scenes plotting to take away everybody's rights, when this government is us.
Yep.
It's, you know, the guy working at the record center or the Social Security Administration or, you know, in the Army or whatever, the civilian people involved with the Army, it's our neighbors. It's our parents, our children, our cousins, our in-laws. There is no behind the scenes plotting cabal is just going to overthrow our entire society. These are people, they are our society. They live in it, they function in it, they're trying to make it better by what they do at their jobs. And I just don't understand this paranoid mentality. It kind of makes me angry.
Well, and when Joe Stack flew his plane into the IRS building back about a decade ago as his protest, you know, the guy he killed was a middle-aged African-American guy who was a bookkeeper with the IRS. I mean, he just, you know, he was supporting his wife and kids. That's us. You know, there might be a few Machiavellian people out there. You know, I like to vilify Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz, but you know, there might be a few power-hungry crazies and a few sociopaths in our government. But nonetheless, it's our government, and it's up to us to change it if we want to. And the way to change it is at the ballot box and in the venue of discourse. It's not with a you know, not some idiot with a Bushmaster.
Well, and that's part of the problem, too. They take these anecdotal stories of, well, some of them are anecdotal. A guy like Cheney who did some illegal things and did plot some things, and they kind of extrapolate that onto the entire mysterious government, like everybody's doing these kind of things.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's wrong. And there's another piece to this, Al, that you're missing. And that is the one of the main reasons why the Republicans are going off so often and so loudly and so angrily on government employees and the government
is that the largest employer in the United States that is unionized, the second largest employer in the United States, is the post office. That's the government. And about 35, it depends on, I've seen several different numbers. I've seen 33, 35, 37.5%, somewhere in the 30s of all government employees. And I guess it's probably higher for federal employees. But in any case, about a third of all government employees are unionized. And so when you hear right-wingers going off on government bureaucrats and government employees, what they're really trying to do is they're trying to break the back of the last union that's left. And because they know that that union is you know, generally more favorable to Democratic candidates than Republican candidates. You know, you got to understand the hidden agenda here.
Go ahead. The other group that's been demonized recently, teachers.
Yeah.
What do they have in common with the Postal Service?
Well, they're unionized.
Probably a majority of teachers are in a union.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's really what it is. They're trying to take down the post office because it's unionized. They're trying to take down the teachers because they're unionized. This is just, you know, a very, very simple power grab by the billionaires. It's the end game of monopoly here. Al, very, very well said. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Excellent, excellent comment. Don in Putney, Vermont. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Yes, Tom. Hi. I'm calling because I believe that the pictures of that horrible tragedy, Newtown, must be available through the Freedom of Information Act. And I know it would be an awfully difficult thing on the family, but I would like to see those pictures put up on the back wall of the Senate chamber and the House of Representatives and the Oval Office for them to look at it.
I'd like to see those pictures being running as the scroll underneath Wayne LaPierre whenever he testifies.
Oh, that would be, what did you call him yesterday?
Bloody Wayne.
Eric. Whatever it was, it didn't do evil to what he actually did. I realize that's a drastic situation, but I just don't think we can't get over the urgency of the situation.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't disagree with you at all, Don. I do, you know, I understand the importance of respecting the families. I understand that traditionally in America, we don't show dead people. And I think that that's a mistake. If you watch, Amy Goodman does a really great presentation of this, or I don't know if she's still doing it, but I saw it a couple of years ago at one of the Greenfests that we both spoke at. She spoke just before me, and I watched her presentation with my mouth open. It was just so brilliant. She showed a side-by-side TV presentation, real-time, of CNN and CNN International reporting on the war in Iraq. And on the left side on CNN US, you saw these cartoons with smart bombs going down chimneys and going poof. And on CNN International, you saw people shooting people and, you know, guts coming out and blood splattering around the walls and things. People around the world are used to seeing war for the horrors that it is, in large part because many of them have actually experienced it. And if you were to try and sanitize it and cartoonize it, they would say, "What the hell are you doing?" But here in the United States, we don't portray war the way that it really is. We don't, you know, Bush didn't even want us to show coffins, if you'll recall, coming back from Afghanistan. And not only do we not show war, but we also don't show the war that's being conducted on American people by the weapons industry, by the Wayne LaPierres of the world. And I'm with you that as much as, you know, I have to swallow really hard to say it, because I do want to respect those families, and I personally don't want to look at those pictures, but I do agree with you that they should be out there. Thanks a lot, Don, for the call. Susan in Clinton, Arkansas. Hey, Susan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've been wondering ever since the filibuster agreement, what kind of relationship did President Obama have with Harry Reid? I mean, he was with John Boehner with the fiscal cliff talks, trying to persuade him for months.
Yeah.
Does he have no influence over Harry Reid?
Legally, he has none, but I am personally of the opinion that if the president had really, really, really wanted to push this thing, if he had gone down to the Senate and he had said to Carl Levin and the other seven or eight senators that were with him, let me take you guys aside. Let's have dinner in the White House. Let's have a conversation about this. By the way, you know, this is what I want. I think probably it would have gone down differently. But, you know,
why would he choose not to?
I don't think it's a matter of corruption. I think that my guess is that the president
didn't want to interfere in the separation of powers. He's a constitutional lawyer. He knows that his job as the head of the executive branch is to be head of the executive branch and not to mess with the legislative branch. That said, he's also a politician.
All the meetings with John Boehner then.
Yeah, that said, my point. That said, he's also a politician, and there are times when he needs to behave like, you know, a little bit more like one, in my opinion. I think he's a great president. There are some areas where I'd like to see a little more Teddy and Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman in him than I'm seeing so far, or Lyndon Johnson for that matter. But, you know, hope springs eternal. We have just about 4 years to go, and a lot can happen. So, Susan, thank you for the call. We'll see where it all plays out. Dave in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just saying earlier about the government, how, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I was taught to believe in Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and God and the government. And if it's like a parental entity for the citizens of the United States, and we're supposed to follow their example, well, all they do is they stay in debt. And I think that's one of the reasons that they let the kids go so bad, is because they didn't really have a grip on the financial situation like they should have. And I think that the government, you know, they just decide, well, we can't pay our bills, so we're going to just vote in a four-month extension, and we'll worry about it in 4 months.
Yeah.
I mean, man, you know, if I couldn't pay my bills for 4 months, I'd still have the bill collectors climbing down my throat,
yeah,
trying,
yeah,
to get every penny they could.
Yeah. Well, that's an argument that you need to take up with Ronald Reagan and both George Bushes, because they ran up virtually all of the debt, and the part that they didn't run up, that ran up during the Obama administration, was run up because of policies, the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, Medicare Part D, and the crashing of the stock market, policies, and the giant tax cut for billionaires, policies that were put into place by George W. Bush. So that's where your argument is. I would suggest you take them up on. Cameron in Lake Isabella, we got about a minute. What's up, Cameron?
Oh, yeah, I just wanted to ask your what your opinion was on medical marijuana being legal in the District of Columbia, since it's federal.
It is legal in the District of Columbia. There are, however, no pot dispensaries. You can't get it. It's legal,
yeah,
but you can't get it.
It's federal land.
Pardon?
It's the District of Columbia is on federal land, isn't it?
It's on federal land, yeah. So it's a weird thing that it's legal, and yet the federal government says it's illegal. And yeah, we looked into that when Louise went through chemo, and it was just, there's no options. It's not available. Cameron, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be back. It is 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We may have Kim Bailey, the Director of Research for Families USA, on as a guest, or we may be taking your calls after the break. Not sure. You never know with these radio roles. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from Health Action 2013, put on by Families USA, the radio row here in Washington, D.C. And with me is Kim Bailey. Kim is the Director of Research for Families USA, familiesusa.org, of course, the website. And Kim, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. This dying for coverage, the deadly consequences of being uninsured. Let's start there and move forward. What's the big carry home from that?
Well, the scary truth is that going without health insurance can have catastrophic effects. People who don't have coverage are sicker and they die earlier than those who do. And
right.
the what we found in our Dying for Coverage report is that thousands of Americans die prematurely each year for a lack of coverage. And it shows the importance of the Affordable Care Act in expanding coverage.
Okay. I just got a note from Shane asking if you would get a little closer to the microphone. So even when Obamacare kicks in, there are people who choose not to buy insurance, and as a consequence of that, they pay a fine or a fee, but they have no access to services, do they, or am I misunderstanding that?
Well, they would potentially not have access to services within at least the health coverage sense. Hopefully they would still potentially buy coverage or buy services out of pocket. But they could potentially be at risk for getting sicker.
They just procrastinate like people always do.
Exactly. Yeah.
And is that seems to me like the Achilles heel of this system, both from a functional standpoint and from a public health standpoint. Is there any conversation about doing something about that?
There is conversation about doing something about it. We're looking at the Affordable Care Act as a building block. It's mm-hmm. a starting point. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we will improve it from here. Obviously, we want to get every American covered, bring everyone into the system, really focus on prevention so that people aren't getting sick in the first place.
Right.
So this is really a starting point.
One of my kids works in one of the Obamacare clinics out on the West Coast that was set up. For low-income people, and I guess this is principally now taking, what, Medicaid folks? I never did ask all the details, but does that cover people who have no insurance whatsoever?
In some cases, it does, yes. There's a great network out there of community health centers and federally qualified health centers that have been serving people. And these new clinics that have been set up to help fill the gaps while we wait for 2014 when people get enrolled and quality coverage will actually cover all the services that
right.
they need.
And the enrollment actually begins this year.
That's right. It begins in October of this year, open enrollment for coverage beginning in 2014.
So what do we need to be telling people to start doing or get ready to do come October?
We need to let them know that options for coverage exist. Many people don't actually know about the Affordable Care Act, don't know that they may actually qualify for the Medicaid expansion or for subsidies to purchase coverage.
So is that the, I mean, is the Obama administration going to start advertising that, promoting that, and when Fox News starts screaming that they're using your federal dollars to promote their damn Obamacare program? I mean, you know, how's that dance going to happen?
I think there's a role for a lot of nonprofits like Families USA and like our sister organization Enroll America mm-hmm. To do a lot to get the word out about the coverage options under Obamacare.
And
there's an effort gearing up right now that will really be an on-the-ground enrollment engagement campaign to let people know what their coverage options are.
I'm an employer. I've got, I don't know, a little less than a dozen employees for this program, our radio program, our TV program. We offer full health insurance to everybody. What should we do?
Keep doing what you're doing.
Just keep that plan going.
Keep that plan going for now.
Okay.
And then potentially, you know, you may want to look at options within the exchange once the exchange is up and running.
Right.
And you may have better options within the exchange than you do currently.
Right. The program we have right now actually comes through our agent who is based in Connecticut. And so we've got, you know, without getting into all the details, but yeah, so we should be looking at D.C. exchanges. Is D.C. setting one up?
D.C. is setting up an exchange. Virginia's going to potentially be setting up an exchange. At least it will have a federally facilitated exchange if it doesn't set up its own.
Yeah.
But there will be a lot more options, and it may be very worthwhile to look into those.
Vermont has already famously said, we're going single payer, as soon as you guys let us. And 2016 is when the Affordable Care Act says that they can do it. That's a long time from now. What do you think the chances are that Congress will actually give them a waiver and let them start it in 2014?
It's a great question, a highly controversial question. I don't know whether they're actually going to get the waiver, but I do know that there's a lot that they can do now to gear up for 2016, 2017.
For example?
They're doing a lot around actually integrating primary care better, and they're really looking at primary care medical homes, trying to get everyone to have a medical home, to have a care team that's caring for them. So real investments in prevention that are fantastic, and they're multi-payer as well. So they're bringing private payers to the table, private insurance companies, public plans, Medicaid.
Vermont is, you mean?
Vermont is. It's a really fantastic thing that they're
doing. Interesting. Interesting. I thought it was just a straight single-payer system.
No, they're bringing a lot of people to the table now because they realize that there's a progression that they need to go through.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, you mean between now and the time that it's implemented or once it's implemented?
Well, there's a sort of, it may look like single payer to a consumer and it may, you know, effectively function like one, but there still may be a role for private players within that system as
like
well.
Like administration.
Sure.
That kind of thing, yeah. Because they already have the system. They already have
you
know, the stuff
that's
in place.
Right.
And in fact, that's how a lot of unions, for example, do it. Big companies that self-insure, they may self-insure, but they actually hire Blue Cross Blue Shield or something to do
to,
the the bookkeeping.
Claims administration, yeah. You need that claims administrator there.
Yeah. Where do you think we're going to be in 5 years, 10 years?
I think we're going to be in a lot better place than we are now.
My prediction is single payer. I think the Vermont is going to be our Saskatchewan. Do you think I'm crazy?
I think 5 years might be a little bit optimistic for that. I think you could be 10 years out looking at something where you're having more of a progression towards that in 10 years.
It's so much less expensive, though. I mean, Canada spends half per person what we spend on healthcare, and they get better results.
They do. They do. Yeah. It's true.
So it seems I think that financial pressure is also going to push up. We'll see. Kim Bailey, Director of Research for Families USA. FamiliesUSA.org is the website. You can read all about it there. Kim, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the great work you're doing and for dropping by. And democracy begins with you. See you tomorrow. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.